You scan the wastewater community for traces of cocaine or opioids to get some sensitive indicator what the cocaine and opioid use in those communities are. You don't consent the people in those communities to having their wastewater checked, right? And so that's a little bit what we're doing with Twitter.
From Stanford University and SiriusXM, it's the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and today Professor Johannes Eichstädt will tell us about how he's using Twitter and Facebook to check the psychological and physical health of the population. He can figure out if a population is stressed, satisfied, depressed, anxious, or happy. It's the future of computational psychology. Social media is everywhere. In fact, 1/4 of adults in the United States report using some form of social media, Facebook, Twitter, and others, Instagram, TikTok, who knows. And it's not just a medium for communicating with others. The language we use and the messages we send is enough to provide a lot of information that allows scientists to look at Twitter and Facebook and infer things about the general population. It doesn't make really predictions that are very accurate for individuals, but over the population, it can tell if generally people are stressed, happy, etc. It can even estimate overall rates of depression. And importantly, the physical health of the population is closely tied to its emotional and mental health. So you can even use these markers in the language that we're seeing in Twitter and Facebook to estimate stress events that might actually lead to physical disorders like heart attacks, coronary disease, lung disease, and others. So it's not just about mental health. It also can have implications for physical health. Professor Johannes Eichstädt is a professor of psychology at Stanford University. He works on analyzing social media to understand and predict trends in health. He'll tell us about correlation between social media and disease, including heart disease. He can dissect the impact of current events on health, even quantifying the number of people who become depressed after a stressful event such as the death of George Floyd. Welcome, Johannes. You know, Facebook and Twitter are used for many things, but I don't think people think about it as something that you would use to measure the psychological state of a population. So really, my first question is, what is the psychological state of a population? Because although I know that individuals have psychological states, I'm a little bit new to the idea that a population might have a psychological state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's very understandable. So there's two senses in which populations have states. And first of all, it's a pleasure to be here, Russ. The first sense is that, of course, communities are just collections of individuals. So we can describe what it's like to be in a community by getting some sense of what the average or the sum of the people living there is like. And I think you can have that felt sense if you drive through different communities, right? If you drive through Palo Alto, you look out of the window, you have a sense of the income distribution, the education distribution. But that also gives you a certain sense of what's probably going on in people's heads, right? So you know what people are preoccupied with. If you've ever overheard a conversation in a Palo Alto cafe, right, there's a certain stereotype of what people are talking about. And that also, it's not just cognition, it's not just the kind of thing people talk about, which has to do with sort of more income and education and sort of business activities, but it also has a certain affective profile, right? I mean, they might be more stressed, but on the other hand, they might also have more positive affect because they can afford certain experience, they have access to networks, they have time autonomy, they have competence, and all these other experiences. So to some extent, it's just a shorthand description of what the profile of people is like in a community. So that is the first sense in which communities have a profile. The second sense is a little more subtle and has historically been a little bit harder to measure. And those are psychological properties of communities that only arise at the community level and that you can't meaningfully talk about by just aggregating across individuals. So, for example, in sociology, we think about this in terms of, for example, social capital. Social capital is the notion of just how many resources do you have in your network? How many people are you connected to? How many people could you draw on in a time of need? These are not things that you can conceptualize without reference to other people. And one of the reactions of the scientific community to our early work, where we were beginning to measure these psychological states of these communities, was to say, ha, you may have finally found a way to measure the social capital and the social cohesion of communities with these tools.
So that's if I can just stop you there, that's fascinating, because my next question was going to be, before we had access to these large data streams from Facebook and Twitter and other social media, how did psychologists measure these two aspects? And I guess you're implying that the second aspect they weren't able to measure. How about the first one? Were there traditional metrics for the psychological state of a population, or is this a whole new field?
No. Of course, I mean, the traditional standard for measuring psychological states is self-report. So you can ask people surveys. There's something like the Behavior Risk Factor Surveillance System by the Centers for Disease Control. 300,000 people a year, about 1,000 people a day get randomly called on the phone. 1,000 people a day is roughly what a political tracking poll will do just before an election. Gallup at some point in time did something similar, so that's a little bit the state of the art, right? So okay. 1,000 people a day is sort of what a very rich society can afford in terms of ongoing measurement. And then we have measurement mechanisms around the world, also again provided by Gallup. I'm thinking here predominantly of the Gallup World Poll. That's about 1,000 people a year across about 100 countries. That's sort of the bar for global comparison.
And so I'm going to guess you're looking at much larger populations.
Yeah, that's the kicker of our methods. No, I mean, we're tracking in the US alone 5 million people, depends on how you count, but we follow Twitter accounts, and we apply, just to sort of outline it quickly, we apply these machine learning and AI pipelines to what people write on social media, and then we infer their psychological states, their positive and negative affect, their enjoyment, their sadness, their happiness, on the one hand, sometimes known as sentiment analysis, pretty straightforward, but also their more subtle psychological traits, their propensity towards certain personality expressions, extroversion, neuroticism, openness to experience, their likelihood that experience depression, anxiety, and life satisfaction and well-being on the other hand.
Great. So I definitely want to get into those, but let's get a big elephant in the room right away, which is
privacy.
Yes. Do these people know they're being tracked? What is our duty to tell them? And what is your ethical framework for approaching all this work?
Yeah. So it splits into two major lines. So the first one is when we do these population surveillance, we call this population surveillance, right? And so there we're roughly in the same ballpark as wastewater monitoring, right? So when you scan the wastewater of a community for
and you mean that in the best way.
In the best possible way, right? But so you scan the wastewater of a community for traces of cocaine or opioids to get some sensitive indicator what the cocaine and opioid use in those communities are. You don't consent the people in those communities to having their wastewater checked, right? And so that's a little bit what we're doing with Twitter. At no point are we ever reporting data on an individual, or would ever do that, right? All an individual is for us, no offense to any individual, is a data point in a giant machine learning system that has 5 million of those, and then aggregates them down to counties and cities, right? And that's then the level that we actually look at the data. So at no point do we actually look at individuals.
Great. And just to be clear, are you able to infer the features of an individual separate from whether or not you would report it? Are there perhaps secure internal databases where you have this Twitter handle is at risk for some personality disorder or a disease? And how do you manage that? And what kind of guarantees could you make? Or does Twitter care about this? Or do the users care? What kind of blowback, if any, have you gotten?
So those technologies have been on the shelf now for 10 years. And that was part of sort of what surprised the world with the overhyped and overmarketed pitch by Cambridge Analytica. They're like, oh, we can do this with mediocre accuracy. But the ability, there's always nuance, right? And so the most important thing to get out of the way is how precise are these methods, right? It's one thing to say it has some significant predictive power, and then how good it is. Age, gender predictions based on what people write on social media, I would say, are solved problems. Prediction of self-reported binary gender with due acknowledgement that there are non-binary choices, and those fall then outside of the correct classification here, are 92% as of a few years ago, based on somebody, say, series, a history of Facebook statuses or a history of Twitter posts. Age gets classified within 4 years as a mean absolute error.
Okay.
So when we ran our algorithms on our own Facebook data, right, they can sort of tell a 32-year-old from a 36-year-old, which is insane. Of course, all of this is happening in the background in the big ad networks in the world, right? All of this is being sold by data brokers to one another to sell ads on you, right? So that's been on the shelf for a while. And so we're doing this. We're characterizing user handles with age and gender in that way, and they live in a secure data environment that is reviewed by, you know, best practice system security people, and this is ethics reviewed and so forth, and to which control is restricted and all of this. Okay, and then there's a class of more perhaps sensitive psychological traits, right? Now we'll say, let's talk depression or anxiety, these models that were built on some training data set where we had a sample, right? For that, you always need some other training. For all of these models, you need some training data set where you had some ground truth and you had the language data, right? And you can encode the connection between the language and the ground truth in the statistical model. And so there, the accuracies in the literature, not just with us, in the literature, for a continuous prediction of depression intensity hover around a correlation of 0.35, maybe 0.4. 0.4 means, if we're generous, 16% of the variance accounted for in the outcome by these prediction models.
So you would not bet the house on these labels?
I wouldn't even bet the garage or the shed. Maybe the dog. The dog's house.
Even though in aggregate, it may be a very useful indication of how the population is doing, any individual would be very noisy in their prediction.
That's exactly the kicker and the danger. It's the kicker because at the population level, the two positive, the false positives and false negatives sort of wash out, right? So everything stabilizes under aggregation, and the little bit of signal you detect comes to the foreground. At the individual level, it's just too noisy to really make dependable predictions.
You've done a series of papers with really fascinating measurements on the population, and having discussed the ethical framework, tell me about some of the exciting health, especially health-related kind of surveillance that you've been able to do, which might be very useful for public health agencies and public policy makers who are thinking about what we need to do for the population health.
A good place to start is our work trying to understand what the community psychological correlates are of heart disease. And there we made a strategic decision. Heart disease is the leading cause of death as a cluster of heart diseases. There are different kinds of heart diseases. Among the heart diseases, the leading kind of sort of sub-heart diseases is atherosclerotic heart disease, which is the end point of the clogging of your arteries, coronary artery disease, which is a very plausible, we say endpoint, a very plausible outcome of a number of behavioral and psychological processes, right? So there are smoking, drinking, are health behaviors that engage in that affect the clogging of your arteries, but then there's also direct physiological pathways. Having stress hormones is a really bad idea for your arteries. And so over the years, just to summarize a little bit, we learned that Twitter in aggregate, right? So population level Twitter, billions of tweets, is a very good system to measure population income and education. But that's not particularly interesting because we have population income and education, right? We have that from the IRS. We have that from Bureau of Labor Statistics. Any government agency gives you this in mind-numbing detail, right? Mind-numbing detail, any detail you'd like at any level of aggregation. Where Twitter really seems to add value are health conditions that have a psychological origin or a meaningfully psychologically influenced. So that means mental health, that means suicides, and that means physical health conditions that are impacted by psychological processes, right? And so among the heart diseases, we picked out this psychologically impacted heart disease, and then we showed that counties where the CDC reports higher mortality rates based as in terms of underlying cause of death on death certificates are communities where there's more hostility in the communities, where there are more expressions of boredom and disengagement, which is also a marker of lower income and so forth, but also just of not having a reason to get out of bed in the morning, think poor health behaviors, and interpersonal tension, right? These are communities that lack social cohesion.
Are we able to detect this at the same time or even earlier than the health outcomes start appearing? Like, should I think about this as a warning system, or is it going to always be lagging the health outcomes? Because if I'm a public health worker, I would say, professor, can you get the information for me early so I can intervene? So I guess my question is the Twitter analysis giving some non-obvious predictions that might be very useful?
We're just moving there. So the methods needed about 10 years to mature. We're just getting to that point. And a key insight was that we were, I'll keep this brief, but we were moving from taking different random samples of the population in different slices, which is sort of what everyone was doing, because Twitter gives you this random feed, 1%, 10% you can pay for, and you can pay for even more, where you get this sort of 10% of all random 10% of all tweets that you can then analyze. But we found out that that's very noisy. And what we prefer to do is we just follow a characterized sample of 5 million user handles over time. And so we build up a digital cohort, just like in hindsight, it's so obvious, just like it's done in epidemiology, just like it's done in demography, right? You follow the same people over time. This way you can see changes. You compare people to themselves over time. And with those technologies, we think we're actually now in the ballpark where we can track meaningful longitudinal change, and we can have an early warning system along these psychological variables. How do these psychological variables relate to physical health? The health literature thinks of them in terms of primordial risk. So stress will predate a mortality event by 10, 20, 30 years, right? Because that's the primordial risk, right? So you are stressed, then you do things that will cause actual risk, right? Smoking, drinking, which then causes heart disease.
This is The Future of Everything with Russ Altman. More with Johannes Eichstädt next on SiriusXM Business Radio Channel 132. Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman, and I continue with Professor Johannes Eichstädt of Stanford University about how we can learn about the mental health of a population by following social media. I started out asking what he observed in the social media during the COVID epidemic and what we can learn from it.
Yeah, let me give in general, the lay of the land around COVID. So I normally like to start just because it's so simple with what Gallup has been seeing. So Gallup's been asking people this very simple question: have you been feeling enjoyment yesterday? Yes or no. Not the most ideal response choice, but that's what they've been doing for quite a while. And then they aggregate this. They aggregate this, say, to the quarter level. And so every 3 months, and you get 59% of the population says yes to that question. And every 3 months, right, it's 59 plus minus 1%, right? So 59, 60, 58, right? That is the range in that measurement.
It's the Gallup Enjoyment Index.
Well, it's the Gallup. They've been bought 3 times, so now it's... so it's an incredible stable measurement. And what I'm trying to say with this is that at a population level, by traditional metrics, psychological measurement doesn't change. And this is in the literature. There's even paradoxes framed around this. There's an Easterlin paradox. Life satisfaction across populations stays flat, no matter what you do to the prosperity in the population over long time periods. It doesn't budge. It did budge during COVID. And it didn't just budge a little bit. It budged extremely. So that number in enjoyment went from 60 to 40.
That's a huge decrease in net enjoyment.
And at the same time, sadness went up by the same amount. So it went from 40 to 60, right? I mean, we see these... It's hard to even describe what's happening because we're missing the language for it. Psychologists are used to effect sizes that are fractions of standard deviations. And at the population level, a fraction of a standard deviation is a big deal. To give you a sense, a standard deviation change is going from an IQ of 100 to an IQ of 115, right? Imagine moving a population from an IQ of 100 to an IQ of 115, right? You give yourself every Nobel Prize and then you retire, right?
Right.
And so what we've seen in well-being is a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 standard deviation change in well-being. And that is a detriment during COVID, right? And that is just... it's hard to even make sense of. It's an equilibrium transition, right? I don't want to use the word unprecedented because we didn't have that measurement in place as well before World War II broke out. I don't know what was going on.
Is this constant over geographies, or are you seeing also huge variability in that reduction of enjoyment?
We don't know yet. We haven't really understood that yet, or the community, the scientific community has not fully understood that yet. But it looks like some of the preliminary data, it looks like it's actually a sort of a lowering tide that's lowering all boats throughout mm-hmm. many communities. Mm-hmm. So we're moving the entire distribution of risk, as we're sometimes saying, right? So the people that are very well are now meh. The people who are meh are now at a -3. The people at a -3 are now in clinical dysfunction territory.
Yes. And we've heard independently that mental health has just exploded as a problem.
So the census during the pandemic ran an emergency household pulse survey. On the basis of that, we figured out that the fraction of the population who was reporting clinically significant distress and anxiety and depression, the two most prominent mood disorders, doubled. So we're talking about a third of the population that was clinically impaired with mental illness.
The pandemic has changed so many aspects of our lives. You know, we're alone, we're at home, our social networks, our work configuration has changed. So I'm wondering, can social media give us insights into the sources of that dysphoria?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, in many ways, that's the beauty of these large-scale language analyses, is that you can unpack the language signal. We call this differential language analysis. And then you can see, here are the things that people value in their life, and here are the things that are detrimental. I can tell you a little bit about what makes people happy in their lives in these population analyses. Is more or less what you'd expect based on the literature, right? So it's people having positive experience, it's hanging out with their friends, it's engaging in exercise activities, particularly engaging in exercise activities outside. You always see language that has to do with being either at the beach or at the mountains. And then there is a huge, this might be peculiar to American society, there's just a huge foodism component of American foodism. Yeah, foodie. Yeah. It's just an endless assortment of nuanced food talk in high quality of life U.S. communities, and beverages and cocktails and particularly caffeinated beverages.
So the discussion of those things correlated with less dysphoria, more
exactly,
happiness.
Higher life satisfaction. And this is also a marker of socioeconomic status and being part of a particular social class. But it is very, very striking that food on social media absorbs more airspace than talking about communities, right?
So you have seen these signals. And going forward, and you mentioned your cohort, and that you're now following people prospectively. So I'm imagining that as current events create other disruptions, you'll actually be able to calibrate this COVID signal to other things, like, for example, the Ukrainian situation or other social perturbations and social shocks. And you'll be able to kind of come up with some kind of measures of how disruptive any individual event might have been on the public conscience.
That's right. That's right. I mean, In 2020, where we saw this signal in the extreme, it was the strongest signal ever seen on Twitter in these systems. It was the strongest signal ever seen on Gallup. Was the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd. The impact on the U.S. population, particularly on the Black American population, was extreme. We published a paper last year that estimated a mental health disease burden in the Black American community of about 1 million additional episodes of depression just from the vicarious trauma of witnessing that murder in the recording.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I think any quiver that we have, any arrow that we have in the quiver that we can use to detect and see and respond to these mental health shocks in the population as these unfortunate things unfold here and unfold around the world, and unfold in, and unfold in the global south, I think is welcome.
So that is really very striking. So is this the future of public health? We have about a minute left. How does this amazing capability that you and your colleagues are generating, how should we think about it going forward? Is it going to become a routine surveillance mechanism? Is it too early to say that? What's the future?
Well, I think it's going to be part of the solution. I think we're, you know, there's always, we're doing science. In science, there's always unknown unknowns. And anyone who jumps from an early result to a fully specced out application hasn't been around long enough, but I think we have early indication that what we have here is a early warning system. We have the potential for an early warning system that can interact with decision makers at county levels, at city levels, at mayors, at the state level, other people who control resources, to deploy those resources where they're most needed, because they need to make trade-off in near real time, right? So think about the opioid pandemic, right? And imagine you're a county person and you have a certain number of naloxone pens that these are given to counter the overdose of opioids or fentanyl. And you need to decide, where do they go? And for that, you can't rely on data that you get from the government that is a year old. You need to know what's happening right now. Right. And if you have a noisy, but at the community level, reliable or at least benchmarked and dependable prediction system that says there is a hotspot here of opioid use, not to police them, but to respond in a public health fashion and say, let's give this to these hospitals, let's give this naloxone pens to these first responders. I think then we've moved forward in a good way.
Thanks to Johannes Eichstädt. That was the future of computational psychology. You have been listening to The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio, Channel 132.